Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Elise Esperanza about her new book, Triage, and I will preview Scott Simon's new memoir, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known. Elise Esperanza's first novel was The Italian Prisoner, a finalist in the Faulkner Wisdom Creative Writing Competition. She's the board chair of the nonprofit New Orleans Writers Workshop, the co-founder of the Wash Ashores Writers Collective in Martha's Vineyard, and writes The Bricklayer's Daughter on Substack. Elise divides her time between New Orleans and Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts, and today we're talking about her wonderful second novel, Triage, a compelling portrait of World War II nurses. Elise, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
What a wonderful story this is. And it is so visual. You can practically see it unfolding in your mind's eye. So tell us about it and tell us how it pairs with your first novel, The Italian Prisoner.
Yeah, thank you. I call it a spinoff from the first novel. Yeah. It's not quite a sequel. The first novel was set in New Orleans in the 40s during World War II. And there was a character, Laura, who was the big sister of the main character, Rose. And all we saw of her were her letters home from the front. She was an army nurse. And doing the research just to write those letters, I became intrigued with the nurses and their stories. And so Laura is the main character in the second book, Triage.
And the nurses' stories are so fascinating.
They are. Yeah, and I went down a little bit of a nurse rabbit hole, I will say, on the letters and the first-person primary source accounts from those nurses, the memoirs, the oral histories. And the more I learned about how close they were to the action and how effective they were in the war, where it was the first time over 90% of the casualties that made it to those tents survived. And that was the first time that happened in a war. So they did a tremendous job. But then when I learned what happened when they came home and got so little credit for what they did, I became a little bit miffed and decided...
So you stood up for them.
Yes, we needed to hear their stories as well.
So in the first book, you had the world of the Higgins Construction Company, and in this one, you have the world of the hospital.
Yes.
Which is something people like to watch and read about.
They do, and I do too. In fact, for the research on this book, I read a lot, but I also watched movies and television stories that were set in hospitals, even TV shows like ER and MASH and Chicago Hope and all of them, and The Pit recently, which was too late for my research, but I still loved it. But yeah, I think it's a very evocative setting, both the hospital itself, Charity Hospital, of course, in New Orleans, and then the hospital tents during the war, and there were some parallels there.
But you got medical procedures and stuff like that in detail in these books.
That was
like
a little scary.
Oh my God.
There's a lot of nasty stuff. I know. And you can almost smell it when you're reading about it with some of the terrible things they saw. Yeah, and that's scary. And I'm not a nurse. And I do have nurses in my family and among my friends. And I did interview a lot of nurses, contemporary nurses, and had them check me on the medical details. So.
Well, talk a little bit about these women, about the different characters, because they are so different. And you have a little bit of every kind of person.
Well, that was what I was going for, so thanks for noticing that. And it's tricky, you know, not writing the same character from one book to the next, even. So Rose in the first book is kind of an ingenue and a younger woman. And Laura is, when she gets to the war, you know, all innocence is lost after that point. So she has some struggles when she comes home. So the challenges that those nurses faced when they came home and how they dealt with it was a big theme in the book, and how little help they got when they returned. But the characters themselves, you know, sometimes they're a little bit of composites of people that you know or that you've encountered in your life. And sometimes some of the characteristics, unfortunately, come from personal or family experience, you know, with tragedy ourselves. And I think historical fiction writers often wrestle with that balance.
And what was it like writing about Charity?
Charity was fun. I mean, and a little scary, too, because you don't want to get it wrong, right? Because there's so many nurses and people in the city who have such a fondness for Charity, the old Charity days. So I had a few of those folks helping me with the research, including one who ran the Charity Hospital nursing program for years and years and provided me with some behind-the-scenes looks. And she's a big reader, too, which is helpful. Danita Quayle, my friend. And then, believe it or not, there are Facebook groups full of Charity alums and full of people who love to talk about New Orleans back in the day. Mm-hmm. And for example, there's a bar in the book that you might have noticed called Joe's, which was a real place. Joe Raviota's lounge was across the street from Charity. And everyone went to Joe's, but I only found that out by putting a question, an open-ended question, in the Ain't There No More New Orleans Facebook group. And dozens of people chimed in and gave me details and pictures and led me to Joe's son, who gave me a call and sent me memorabilia. So for a while, this could have been a book about Joe's lounge, but
still could.
I dialed it back a little bit. But yeah. So New Orleans people love to talk about New Orleans history. Mm-hmm. And that's been a real blessing for me in writing both these books.
Talk about Italian New Orleans of that period.
Yeah.
What you learned and what people did tell you.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm Italian, and I have to point out right away, I'm not Sicilian, which is a different thing. But in New Orleans, most of our Italians are Sicilian. Mm-hmm. And they will be quick to tell you that. So early on when I moved here 24 years ago now, I met some folks who were involved in the Sicilian community here, including Chef Joe Feroldi, who has Lakeview Burgers and Seafoods, and told me stories about growing up Italian and about the Italian POWs. And that's how I learned about that. But then I did some research on, well, how did they get here? And, you know, the influx of Sicilians in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to New Orleans and all the traditions and foods and, you know, customs that they brought with them. And then, you know, over the decades became assimilated. So by the 40s, they were really all over the place, not just in the Lower French Quarter, but also in, you know, in Metairie and Lakeview and other places as well. So, and had kind of worked themselves into the business community and the civic life of New Orleans.
And the lives of women were so different.
Oh, yes. Yes,
so
they were.
It's hard, hard, hard.
Yes. And yes and no. You know, in writing this book, one of the takeaways for me was what these nurses faced as they came home and were not taken seriously about their health. They were not given access to the GI Bill. They were not given access to even fraternal organizations like the VFW or anything like that. And when they came home, I read some testimony that nurses had given about trying to gain access to health benefits, for example. And they were basically told, you'll be fine. Women are resilient. And they were sent on their way.
Oh, my gosh.
But of course, they weren't fine. Nobody was fine when they came home from a war. And what I realized in doing the research was these medical professionals were right on the front line. So when we think of MASH or the Korean War or wars that followed, there were helicopters. There were no helicopters in World War II. And of course, we knew that kind of intellectually, but when I read that, I'm like, of course, they had to be very, very close to the front line. Mm-hmm. So the wounded were coming in on stretchers and in ambulances. And so they were seeing all kinds of carnage. And of course, it had an impact on them. And they were young. They were so young.
And there was this moment where two nurses say, oh, well, they use DDT all the time on the farm.
Right.
And it was like such a clever detail.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should bring that up because in the original draft, one of the early drafts, there were probably 3 pages about that DDT. And, you know, this is the challenge for historical fiction writers. I had to dial that back because it was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I know so much about
that
this.
These nurses got sprayed with DDT powder, which was the lesser of two evils at the time, apparently. But really, it ended up being a couple sentences in the book, so... You can read all about it on my nerd appendix on my website, though.
My nerd appendix.
Yes, that's my consolation. I don't throw it all away. I put it in the nerd appendix.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Elisa Speranza, whose new book is Triage. There's so much. You had to know the war in North Africa.
Yes.
You had to know nursing skills. You had to know Italian New Orleans.
Right.
You set yourself some ambitious storytelling goals with this book.
I did. My coach, my writing coach, Allison Alsop from New Orleans Writers Workshop, tried to caution me at the beginning of this. And I really wanted to do it. I wanted to show the full picture because I felt as though these women had been kind of written out of history. And I wanted to write them back in. When I went to visit Anzio, there was a plaque on the cemetery. This is the big cemetery where they have all the U.S. war dead from Anzio and from the Sicily campaign. So it's a very moving place. But on the memorial, the plaque said, "In proud remembrance of the achievements of her sons and in humble tribute to their sacrifice, this memorial has been erected by the United States of America." And I had just visited Ellen Ainsworth's grave.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, what about the daughters? And why is there not a Band of Sisters movie? Mm-hmm. So really, it was very important to me to get in the entire sweep of the war, but also the aftermath and what happened to them when they came home.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the Anzio Shakes.
The Anzio Shakes was a real thing. And there was a memoir, I stumbled across that reference in one of the memoirs written. There's a memoir called A Half Acre of Hell, which was the nickname for Anzio because the troops, our troops, were pinned down there for months. Mm-hmm. And the Germans had the high ground and they were just shelling and shelling and shelling. And people were in bunkers and they were in trenches and the command of the army had moved into caves. So they were protected, but the field hospital was not in a cave. You know, they were right outside. So the nurses and some of the doctors, too, were just under constant barrage night and day. And a lot of them did develop this condition they called the Anzio Shake. So it was an uncontrollable shaking. And then I had the detail about the DDT, which had to have had neurological impacts, you would think, right? So it could be that a combination of those things. But I think the trauma of the war and the shelling and the bombing and the day-to-day uncertainty of whether you were going to live to see tomorrow was just incredibly stressful.
Now, I'm curious, in your research, if you found the National World War II Museum to be
Absolutely.
A great place for you.
Yeah, it's really, we are so blessed to have that here and have that resource right in our community. And right from the first book, even Kim Geis over there, who's one of the archivists, was an incredible resource for me. And just wandering around, sometimes I just go over there, I'm a member, and I just go and wander around if I want to refresh my memory. Like Anzio has a whole section there.
Sure.
And so when I was writing and I would read about things, but to go there and hear the narration and see the pictures and the artifacts, that's very, very helpful as a writer to get three-dimensional depictions of things that you can describe in more detail rather than just the words.
Mm-hmm. And just to stand there in the middle
yes.
of it all, it's just
yes.
humbling, I'm sure.
And they had one, for a long time, there weren't a lot of women in the World War II Museum.
Yeah.
There was one case that had a nurse's uniform and her little kit. I would joke around to Kim about it. And then a couple of years ago, Kim actually curated a magnificent exhibit called Our War II, which was all about the women. And so that came along right in time for my book. And I got a lot of great stuff out of that. Even things like the scrapbooks that they kept. You know?
Oh, scrapbooks always get to me.
Aren't they great?
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, little artifacts and things, you know, funny things that they would keep, mementos of dances and things, because you had to have some lighthearted moments. I mean, and this book is it's a little heavy in terms of the subject matter.
But there are moments.
But there are some lighthearted moments. And part of that is, you know, what I wanted to convey too, just that female friendship and the camaraderie under fire and how important that is. And it still is to all of us today, you know, as we cherish our women yeah. friends.
And the urgency of romance.
Oh, yes.
In times like that.
Well, yes. And maybe perhaps making decisions that you might not make otherwise.
That's right. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Elisa Speranza, whose new book is Triage. So talk a little bit about writing your Substack letter and what sorts of things people write you about.
It's been really fun. I started it about a year and a half ago, and it was a way to stay in touch with readers in the very long interval between books, because a lot of my readers and family and friends, too, they're not on social media, and so they're not getting my posts, and they're not, you know, I'm not able to call them up all the time or email them and text them to talk to them. So I wanted to share kind of the behind-the-scenes process of writing the book, but in the research and things like that. And I found that people I didn't expect to pipe in, you know, on the Substack comments are out there. And it's been really great. And it's grown to over 1,000 subscribers. And there's a lot of great writers on Substack. I guess I was inspired probably by Maurice Carlos Ruffin and by Jamie Attenberg, who both have enormous Substack followings.
Oh, yeah.
And they've both been very generous and helpful to me as well in writing this book. So it's been fun. And then every once in a while, someone will chime in, like my high school English teacher.
That
just made my day when my high school English teacher, you know, put up a comment and said, I'm so proud of you, you know. So I said, well, thanks to you, Mr. Weber, you know.
That is so nice.
So it's cool. It's been fun. And I used to be, many, many years ago, I worked in journalism. So for me, it's more like writing a newspaper column. And it's a little more of a reflex for me than the fiction is, you know, definitely a lot heavier of a lift.
So what are the goals for you in doing that newsletter?
A few things. One is to just, as I said, stay in touch with readers, but also to give them a glimpse, those who aren't writers, of what a writer's life is like. I think people are interested. Yeah. And when I do a lot of book clubs and a lot of public speaking, and I always get those questions about, you know, what is your routine like, or how did you come up with that character, or how do you, you know, how do you do your research? How do you put the book together? So I think just giving people that glimpse of it, but also to let them get to know my characters a little bit better as well, and the themes of the book, so that they understand as they're reading it or after they read it, what went into it and where they might find out more information. I try to also highlight other people's books and other writers in my Substack, because there's so many, you know, even just in the World War II genre, there's so many great books.
Oh, yeah.
But obviously, the other thing I like to do with the Substack, I'm a huge supporter of libraries and indie bookstores. So I use the Substack to really highlight. I was just at Independent Bookstore Day, and I visited three of our local bookstores and had a blast. And
we're so lucky.
You know, we're so lucky here to have such a great literary community. So I try to use the Substack as a platform to harangue people into buying books from indie bookstores and getting them from libraries instead of, I don't know, other places they could get their books.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
She'll go nameless.
Now, and you have used a model of publishing that's a little different. So talk about how that's working out for you.
It's working out great. The first book I put out under my own imprint, which is Burgundy Bend Press. And for the second book, I thought about maybe, you know, trying to go a traditional route. But the more I weighed the pros and cons, the more I made the affirmative decision to put the second book out under the imprint as well. So it's a little micro press. And I actually helped another local author publish his book this last year in it as well, Lewis Gertler. It's great. I get to control all the inputs and outputs and the timing of it all. And it's
been beautiful cover.
The cover is from a painting by John Langford, who is an artist and musician friend of mine. So no AI covers in my books. You know, for me, having that kind of control over not just the book, but the marketing of the book was really important. Mm-hmm. And the first book did very, very well. I've sold thousands of copies of The Italian Prisoner. It's still popular. I'm still getting calls from book clubs. So I'm hopeful that the second book will catch on as well.
Hey.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Elisa Speranza, whose new novel is Triage. You can meet her Thursday, May 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Elisa, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Mixing the potion in a vial of glass. I drink it to silence the voice in my head. Seducing death with the slightest of keys. Just like
why is it we so love stories of other people's pets? Is it because they inevitably lead to remembering our own heartfelt adventures? Probably. And maybe it is because these stories reveal us in all our humanity, loving and caring, playful and wise, ready to learn from our animal companions, grateful for their always too short lives. Scott Simon, the beloved host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, chronicles life in his own family menagerie in Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I've Known, with charming line drawings by Liana Fink. The Simons are a family of animal lovers, and so it is they bring home a parade of lovable creatures. Daisy, the French poodle who writes haiku, Gato Blanco, the foster cat, and a handful of love called Bagel the hamster. Oh, and a barrel of worms takes up residence on the balcony. Pet lovers, you know immediately. These are my people. Of course, Simon grew up with animals. The family dog, Penny, awaited his arrival home from the hospital. When he was a little older, he had a grasshopper, Hoppy, for a while. Neil Simon was a memorable turtle. The Simons have a gift for names. Salmon Fishty may be my favorite. And so, Scott grew up with an appreciation of the open heart and the welcoming home. In his professional life, Scott Simon has covered the pets of Sarajevo, a war-torn city he came to love, Inky, an octopus and escape artist who liked to get out of his tank at the National Aquarium of New Zealand. And he shares the story of those who lost pets in Hurricane Katrina and what we learned from that. We didn't meet a single Mississippian or Louisianian who had left behind a pet, who wasn't anxious and regretful about leaving them. It was often the loss they feared the most and found the most irreplaceable. In the chapter Gatto and the Novelist, Scott Simon shows us how pets even improve our work lives. I was interviewing a novelist who is a superb writer, but unaccustomed to interviews. There were stops, starts, ums, and uncertainties. Meanwhile, Gatto Blanco had moved under the corner of the broadcast table, preparing to leap onto the top and saunter over to the microphone to offer his own insights. Except, I'd recently placed a tray on that spot to hold books. Gatto's runway was occupied. I angled my chair slightly for him to leap into my lap as I continued to listen to the author and offer questions. Gatto clambered on. He nudged my chin with the top of his head. I began to stifle a sneeze from sniffing in the cloud of his fluff. The move to take a hand from holding Gatto in place to put those fingers just under my nose gave him the opening he craved. Gatto nudged the microphone stand with his soft pink nose. The author, our producer, our editor, and I all heard the scraping. And then he put his nose against the microphone. There was a springy thunk of cat's notes on foam. The author halted. Our producer said, "Hold up." Gatto decided he liked how the slick pink of his nose felt against the squishy gray foam of the microphone and pushed it again. Once, twice, three times more. "Sorry, it's our cat," I explained. "Gatto Blanco. He only interrupts the best authors." I offered a few names. The novelist laughed. "How cute. How is he? Tell him thank you for me. I don't feel so nervous now," she said. And indeed, Gatto's unscheduled appearance seemed to lend her a little more comfort and confidence, sharpened her answers, and helped relax. She had joined an accomplished circle. Novelists, political figures, and artists whom Gatto Blanco wanted to hear and chose to join. The interview went on, but better. I moved Gatto to a spot by my feet, and he sauntered off to his next stop as if to acknowledge, "My work here is done." Scott Simon appears live and in conversation with actor and author Brian Batt, Monday, May 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tickets are required for admission and include a copy of Ulysses S. Cat to be signed by Scott Simon following his presentation. This event is in partnership with WWNO, and donors will be invited to a special meet and greet with Scott Simon.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Louisiana children's picture book author Margaret Simon signs and reads her new board book. What's That Sound? Birds of the Bayou, Saturday, May 9th at 1 at Octavia Books. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans meets Saturday, May 9th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School to discuss David Copperfield, chapters 58 to 64, to select a book for the coming year. Catherine Stockett discusses her new book with E.M. Tran and signs The Calamity Club, Saturday, May 9th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Octavia Books welcomes a very special guest, Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, when he comes to town to present his new book, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known. He will appear live and in conversation with actor and author Brian Batt, Monday, May 11th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Tickets are required for admission and include a copy of Ulysses S. Cat to be signed by Scott Simon following his presentation. This event is in partnership with WWNO, and donors will be invited to a special meet and greet with Scott Simon. More information at octaviabooks.com. Elisa Speranza appears in conversation with Allison Alsop and signs Triage, Thursday, May 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Gary Hoover appears in conversation with Will Sutton and signs Reality or Lottery, Economic Promises and the Reality of Who Gets Ahead, Thursday, May 14th at 6 p.m. at Baldwin & Company. And coming up, the Symphony Book Fair Sale 2026 will be held at the UNO Lakefront Arena on Saturday, May 30th and Sunday, May 31st. Sale hours are on Saturday from 9 a.m. until 6 p.m. There'll be an entrance fee from 9 a.m. until 12 p.m. on Saturday only. Sale hours on Sunday are from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. There'll be a special children's book sale on Sunday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m., where children accompanied by an adult can decorate a shopping bag, then fill it with selections from our children and young adult tables. There are more than 50 categories of books, including fiction, mysteries, sci-fi and fantasy, cookbooks, history, religion, the South, art, and biographies. There will also be artwork, frames, sheet music, CDs, audiobooks, DVDs, vinyl records, puzzles, and games. All proceeds benefit the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. For more information, visit lpovolunteers.org.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.